Good morning. So last time we talked about a few miscellaneous optimizations. One was about removing redundant operations from loops. You mentioned that common reasons a compiler might not do this for you, even though it's fairly mechanical, is that if you like have a function call, the compiler doesn't know whether that function call actually does something different each time or not. Or if you have like an if statement, the compiler might have a little trouble figuring out that, oh, this, you know, these two if statements are related to each other, and we can like use only one of those conditions. So you can help the compiler by manually sort of adjusting your loops to do some work outside of the loop, or like splitting your loop into two, like we suggest for the smooth assignment. We talked about vector or SIMD instructions. So these were instructions where we had these extra wide registers we'd add to our processor that could hold this little fixed size array of values. And we had instructions that would perform an operation on pairs of values between two vectors. So we could basically do what was previously a whole bunch of, say, add instructions as one big add instruction that did lots of adds or other arithmetic operations. I mentioned that the sort of typical implementation is that the processor has this extra wide ALU and extra wide data cache accesses. And the sort of reason why that might be worth doing is that, well, you know, once we're doing sort of our out of order multiple issue processor, we're actually devoting a lot of our chip space to just figuring out what instructions to run when, fetching instructions, and so on. So this is a way to add a lot of capacity to the chip without actually adding that much stuff overall. And I mentioned, so we have these vector instructions, how do we use them? So one option, if our compiler isn't smart enough to figure out, oh, this is how we can use these vector instructions on your code, you can tell it manually with these vector intrinsics, which are basically just C functions that compile into a particular instruction or like very short sequence of instructions, where you're basically telling the compiler, yes, please use the vector instruction for exactly this. And this is kind of an easier way than our, you know, alternative of just, you know, writing assembly, which would be very tedious for a lot of the things you want to do, but gets around the issue of compilers being a little weird in how they can sometimes figure out how to use vector instructions and sometimes not on the on their own. So questions about things we covered last time? Yes. Sure. Go over question number one on the quiz. So question number one on the quiz is asking which of these would we have problems because of aliasing with doing these optimizations. So the first is unrolling the loop with index j. And I don't think there's any aliasing problems here, because what we'll do is we'll copy this line and find replace j with j plus 1. Right? So we don't need to do things that we may have seen to avoid, like, for example, you might say, oh, shouldn't we just load C of I once? We don't need to do that, right? We can still unroll the loop and have two writes C of I plus equals, C of I plus equals twice. That's still unrolling. That's going to be our first step in unrolling. And if we're doing that, there's no aliasing issues. We're still doing the same accesses to C of I. So I think what people who thought that we couldn't do this were doing is that they assumed that if we unrolled this loop, we would put CFI in a temporary variable. But you don't need to do that. That's not part of unrolling the loop. That's a different optimization. It's a good optimization to do, but it's a different optimization. Then we have swapping the I and J loops. So that would change the order in which we write to CFI versus when we read from A or B. And if C, and if elements of A were also the same memory address as C, so like we had one big array and we passed different parts of it as our pointers A, B, and C, then that could cause different results because we'd be reading back a value we wrote in one of the loop orders and not the other. So questions about those explanations for question one? Yes. So the question, for B and C, is changing the order of accesses, that's the problem? Yes, and the reason why that's a problem is because we have to be concerned is when we write to something, are we going to read that back later? And if the answer is yes, it better be the case in both orders that we're going to read back in the same cases. And that's, we don't have anything that would guarantee that if we do these transformations unless we're doing like lots of checks. Which we could do, but we're asking where it would be, cannot easily do it without adding some check. Yes?
If you did have a tail missing problem and you unrolled it, would you actually get performance benefit?
The question, if I had an aliasing problem and I enrolled it, would I get a performance benefit? Yes, because we'd still be omitting, you know, most of this J less than N comparisons and this plus plus J logic, we would simplify. So we should still get a performance benefit. Now, it's not going to be probably nearly as good as the performance benefit we would get from keeping C of I in a register. But note that that's actually an optimization we can do without unrolling. That if I wanted to keep C of I in a register, I could do that here and store it here without unrolling, and that would give me a separate performance benefit that would probably be, well, that might be more significant than the unrolling. Other questions? Yeah. So the question is, for two, why isn't A right? Because in that case, the loop would be completely unrolled, and it would get rid of loop overhead. So that would be true if N was a constant. But the problem is that in this code, if we're implementing the function foo, N is an argument. So we need to write code that works regardless of what N is. So if we have a fully unrolled version for N equals 2, we need to have an if statement to see whether to use it. And that's probably not going to end up really being faster in the because we're probably not going to write our code to make that the fast case, right? You know, when we're unrolling, we're typically thinking about making larger numbers the fast case. Does that answer your question? Yes.
Do you mind going over question 5?
Can I go over question 5? Sure. So question 5 is saying, after we do add vector instructions to some originally non-vector instruction code, you know, what's going to happen to our code typically? So one thing is that we're going to probably perform more work in the inner loop, because remember our first step of doing vector instructions is trying to extract those like 10 adds at a time, or 10, or not 10, like 8 adds at a time, 8 loads at a time operations. And we're going to have to do at least one of those every iteration of the loop, and our typical serial code, especially that's not written with optimizations in mind yet, is going to do one thing per iteration, right? The natural serial code. Some people might have been confused by thinking about, oh, but we unrolled for optimization. I agree. Though, if you apply the idea that we can do loop unrolling, you can do loop unrolling to vectorize code, in which case, if your normal scalar code had an unrolled loop where you did like 4 elements in iteration, and you have vectors of 8 elements, well, if you do the same thing on your vectorized code, you do 32 elements in iteration. And unrolling will give you speed up with vectorization. Second question part was the function's machine code would be 8 times longer. It probably shouldn't be, because it's going to be probably a similar length. It's going to be a bit longer because we have to like handle leftover and things like that. But it's not going to be longer proportional to the size of our vector, because we're basically just changing how much the loop increments by, not like making copies of the loop or something like that. Yes?
That was for question 6, but great.
Oh, whoops. Okay, you were asking about question 5. Okay. Yes, not reading question numbers. Okay, so question 5. So the question is, which of these is most simple to optimize using vector instructions, using what we discussed in lecture? So in the case of snippet B, snippet B is easier, and the problem is because there's an issue with snippet A. So for snippet A, to compute A of 1, we need the prior value from A of 0. And when we vectorize this, we're going to change this loop, so most likely we're going to compute A of 0 and A of 1's new value at the same time. And that means that when we compute the A of 1 value, we won't have the benefit of having previously computed the new A of 0, which is what the original serial code expects. So this seems very tricky to work out, and there's not a way using the sort of vector instruction techniques we discussed in lecture to do it. There's probably something you could do, but it's a bunch of extra work to make that work. In the case of snippet B, we don't have that sort of dependency. We're always using values that are ahead, so we can just load the original A value somewhere, use them, and that's a lot easier to deal with. Yes? Question, is there an index out of bounds error? So for snippet A, not necessarily, because A could be a pointer to a middle of an array. And hopefully is. So accessing A of minus 1 then wouldn't be a problem. Other questions? Okay, sorry about... Question number, okay. Okay, so I believe last time we finished up on this question, and I just have a cleaner explanation slide for this than I showed last time. So something to note is here that I was trying to vectorize this code here, and I decided, wait a moment, you know, I really want to store things into A of I, like a bunch of A of I's, so I decided I'd vectorize it by sort of expanding the operations based on I, not based on J. And that's mainly because it's a lot easier to store four different values of A of I than the same value of A of I multiple times. Like, there's ways of doing both. Like, when you do the lab this week, you'll discover how to, like, do a big sum like that. But I decided to vectorize it this way, and that's why the answer to our exercise was C, where we did one J at a time and did that set one operation. And this is the sort of choices that come up when you're doing vectorization, is you want to think about, well, you know, what is the thing I can easily do as these sort of sets of, you know, a fixed array operations. Okay, some questions? Okay. So, yes. The exercise. So this code in the exercise is doing the I have expanded the I loop. That's the. But the reason I would have chosen to do that is because it's a lot easier to write to different elements of A than to sum up a big element of A. I'm not sure which is actually faster, but certainly easier to write. Yes. So the set one is producing a vector that contains a bunch of copies of B of J. Other questions? Okay. So we showed you doing vector instructions. We showed you sort of the assembly interfaces and these intrinsic functions that Intel made up. I would note that there's other interfaces for writing vector stuff. So GCC has some vector extensions, which kind of look more like normal C code. You have like a type for each vector, and like the plus operation works. GPUs are kind of basically vector machines, in that they're GPU processors. One of the big things they do that makes them efficient for certain computation is that they have lots of vector instructions, including fancier things. And typically, the way you program GPUs often looks more like writing multi-threaded code, writing code that, you know, if we were thinking of it on a normal processor, you'd run on like several cores at once. So you write that style of code, but it turns into something that runs as vector instructions. To support this kind of thing, especially what GPUs do, there are mechanisms for allowing vector instructions to do things like conditionals and like loading values that are contiguous. So we haven't seen many of these instructions in x86. They exist in recent versions, but they're kind of a more newer thing. And one of the reasons why lacking them is one of the reasons why making things use vector instructions is kind of hard. So that those sorts of features that sort of more dedicated vector machines like GPUs have, you know, kind of not come to general purpose processors so quickly. And because, well, they're complicated to implement in hardware. Some questions? So, one last thing about optimizations. And this is sort of general practical advice for optimizing. So, if you're actually optimizing a real program, you know, you're on a job, you want to make a program fast, what should you do? First thing, ask your compiler. Make sure you're asking your compiler to optimize your code fully. You know, don't waste your time doing optimizations by hand if you like haven't actually set your compiler to optimize as much as it can, or experimented with that, because that's a lot faster. And then make sure you're spending the effort where it matters. So a common mistake with big programs, like you have in the real world, or maybe not that big, but things that aren't like our assignments where, well, it's one function, right? Of course, you know, you have to make the function fast, is that people often make the wrong guesses about what they need to optimize. So people will say, oh gosh, this program's so slow. I'm going to optimize all this computation in here. You know, and it doesn't get any faster. They assume their optimization isn't working. And what's really happening is that their program spends 90% of its time parsing text. And they really should have optimized the text parsing. You know, and this sort of thing where you're just optimizing the wrong routine, common mistake, and there are tools to help you avoid this issue, known as profilers, which should be your first step after you tried to ask the compiler to help you in optimizing. So tools that determine where your program spends its time. So in Linux, there's a tool called perf is an example. There's a whole bunch of examples of these. And basically what perf does is you run your program and periodically it stops your program and does a stack trace. It sees what's on the what the call stack is, records that, and it consolidates that information to figure out, you know, on average, where were you in the program? So, as an example, here's part of the output of perf running on HCLRS. So I ran HCLRS doing interpreting a HCL file for a lot of cycles and got these results here. And it's showing me the percentage of its 37,000 samples that occurred in each function, and it has these two columns. So children means that it occurred in this function or something it called. So everything is in main because that's where the program started. So that's why main has 100%, but that doesn't mean I should optimize the main function itself, because usually main was calling something else. And you can see that pretty much none of our samples were actually from main, they were just from things that main was calling. And that's this self column. And you can see from this function name that, well, okay, so you were spending a lot of your time in this run a program function, in this evaluate an expression function. And wait a moment, we were spending a lot of time making a hash in a part of the hash map code. So this tells me that, contrary to what your guess might be on why it takes HTLRS a while to interpret something in lots of cycles, that a lot of what's happening, you know, like we're spending 10% of our time getting values out of hash maps. And probably more than that, because we're spending a bunch of our time, like 20% of our time hashing something. So that tells me that, hey, if I want to optimize this code, probably I should look into why I'm using a hash map for something that's very important in my loop and try to maybe choose a better data structure, like maybe something where I don't have to hash my keys all the time. Yes? Question is, what is self versus children? So when we take a sample, we have our call stack, and if the bottom of the call stack, the function we're actually executing instructions in, is something, we count it as self. If it's anywhere up the call stack, we count it in children. So this means that every sample included main, but only the samples that, and like a bunch of samples included this make hash function, but this make hash function apparently called something, so like half the time we were actually in make hash, and the other part of the time, which, you know, gave us this extra 20% after 23 to 41, you know, that difference is because some of the time make hash was calling something else and we were in that other function. Yes?
So would we only really care about the self time?
So question, would we only really care about the self time? Not really, because if I'm thinking about optimizing this, knowing that I'm in this make hash function 40% of the time is probably more useful information, because what I should be thinking about is, can I avoid computing hashes at all? And that other stuff the hash function is doing is part of that time. But having both of these pieces of information is helpful, because like I certainly don't want to like look at this, say, this running a program function and assume it's my bottleneck, which I might do naively. But for example, you know, this make hash function's probably calling, like, I don't know what else it's calling, but it's probably calling some of the other functions down here. And like, for example, memcomp, we don't really care about the time spent in that. We really want to think about what other functions do that, are doing that uses memcomp. And I guess I would note that I haven't shown it here, but what these pluses are is that I can expand and get a breakdown of, oh, what functions was it calling? So I can like try to interpret what part of the children time I actually care about, what optimizations make sense based on that. Other questions? So that's our just on profilers. So we're not going to like have you use one. But if you're doing optimizations in the real world, typically you'll have these sorts of issues where, you know, if you don't run a profiler, you probably won't make the right guess. Like, you probably wouldn't have glanced over the HTLRS code, maybe more than glanced over it, and guessed, I wouldn't have guessed that, oh, hash maps are where we're spending a lot of our time. And that's probably a very different optimization than what you do if you're like, you looked at our list of optimizations and looked at the HTLRS code. You think, oh, let's do loop unrolling or something like that. Completely different thing based on this profiling that we should do. Okay, so that's everything I have on optimizations. So we're going to go on to a different topic, which is about sort of hardware support for running operating systems. To talk about that, I'm going to talk about this program here. So here's a program that just runs an infinite loop. I have a question here. So if I run this on a shared department machine, if I SSH into portal, compile this program and run it, can you still use that machine? Who thinks yes? Who thinks no? Okay, so plurality thinks yes, and the rest of you have no opinion. Okay, what if the portal machine you logged into had one core? Who thinks you could still use it? Who thinks you couldn't? Okay, so the answer is you could. So I'd say, why is that? Because if you think of what this compiles into, there's no way for anything else to run. But yet, that happens. So one way we can investigate this is I can do a different version of this infinite loop. And here I'm just timing. So I have this getTime function, which gets me a timestamp. I'm comparing my timestamp, calling getTime, and getTime again. And what we'd expect is that we have sort of this fixed amount of time between those two calls. You know, maybe there'll be some variation initially because of like cache misses, but after that, we'd expect it to be the same every time, right? We just run the getTime instruction and then the other, and we'd expect basically the same difference each time. And I have this, which I just collect this big number of timings. So I ran this on a busy machine, and here's a plot of the numbers I got. Note that that's a log scale on the left side. So typically, the difference was, you know, like 20-ish nanoseconds. But we have these peaks where it's like 10 to the 7 nanoseconds. So, you know, many milliseconds. We have these other sort of lesser peaks where it's sort of several microseconds. So it's not consistent. Something's going on. So what's happening? And well, I mentioned this was a busy system. So one thing which is happening is I'm running my infinite loop. And sometimes there's this random like million cycle delay. And well, what's really happening during that million cycle delay is some other programs are running. So somehow I'm in the middle of my loop. I'm calling my getTime function in between. Sometimes just randomly some other programs run. So how does that happen? So we're going to talk about how does that happen. And this is known as time multiplexing, that I'm sharing over time a single core. Well, I, not me personally, but the operating system is responsible for this. And there's going to need to be a hardware mechanism for this because there's no instruction here that says switch to SSH. Right? So the hardware needs to have some way of letting the OS do the switch to SSH. And it's pretty good that we have that, because if we think of like doing this on portal, if we didn't have that, then you could just, you know, run stuff on portal and make it completely unusable. And what happens is that actually the operating system runs for a little bit of time in between. And there's a mechanism by which the hardware runs the operating system without the current program requesting it. And this mechanism is known as an exception. So these are hardware exceptions. They're different than the exceptions you learned about for like Java. But the name is exception. So the exception is a hardware mechanism which will run the operating system in the middle of something else. So the operating system gets to run. And when it runs, it arranges so that when it returns from that exception, it returns to a different program. And from my program's point of view, my program just, you know, it took a million extra cycles to run some instruction. But what really happened is the processor was doing other things, other instructions for other programs and the OS. some questions about this time multiplexing idea. Yes? So question is, why would this allow multiple programs to run at once in a single core? So they don't actually run at once, as you've noticed, but we can do this frequently enough that it appears they run at once. So note that when I had my picture here, that my peaks here were like 10 to the 7th nanoseconds. That's 10 milliseconds. Like, from a human point of view, that's going to be hard to notice. Yeah. Why doesn't the OS, what do you mean, take you back to the loop you're actually...
Like, why does it go back to loop.exe?
Why does it go back to this program eventually?
Like, yeah, or why doesn't it before?
Why doesn't it...
Like, why does it go to SSH?
So why does it decide that after this exception happens, I should run SSH instead of loop? So there's different policies OSs will have for this. And this often depends on how it was configured. But the typical notion is that we want every program to get a chance to run every once in a while. So we're going to, you know, try to run SSH if it hasn't run recently. And also typically we're going to try to prioritize programs which have just become runnable. So for example, if I just typed something so SSH can run when it couldn't before, you know, that would be a good time to run SSH. In operating systems, 4414, if you take that, we'll talk a lot more about the sort of ways we'd make the choice of what program to run. There's a lot of decisions with trade-offs there as far as like how usable, how responsive is my machine versus how efficiently do I run computations. Other questions? Yeah?
For this SSH, it's on the department machine, so you have to actively check if somebody sends requests for SSH?
Question, for SSH on department machines, does something have to send, like, check if someone sends a request, like if SSH has something to do? So one of the things the operating system's going to do that we'll talk very briefly about from a hardware point of view later is that the operating system is responsible for managing input and output on behalf of programs. So because of this, the operating system is going to know when the SSH program has input from the network or input from a keyboard, and therefore know whether it's able to run based on that. Okay, other questions? Yeah. Question, if SSH or Firefox don't need to run indefinitely, will it run them until they're done? So in the case of SSH, until it's like waiting for the next input, or in the case of Firefox, until it's not. This is another decision with trade-offs. So typically the strategy is that the operating system will set a maximum amount of time it will let things run before it switches to something else. And often this is on the order of, you know, a couple milliseconds on a modern machine. I said the maximum time before switching to something else. The maximum time before switching to something else, assuming you can run something else. Great. If there's nothing else to run, obviously you won't bother switching. Yes? So the question, if there's nothing else to run, will the operating system still hop in and take it back where it was originally running? Most likely, yes. It depends why this exception happened. We'll talk about reasons exceptions can happen in a bit. Other questions? Okay. So we saw this mechanism where the operating system starts instead of a normal program. And one thing that needs to happen here is that we need to switch from one program to another. So how does that work? And this means that the operating system is going to need to save the information about the program that was running, about our loop, including saving the program counter. We need to remember where in the loop were we, so we can go back to it, And we also need to remember all the register values. Then we need to switch to the new program, to SSH in our example. So we need to set all the registers that SSH was expecting. Presumably these are registers we saved earlier. And the program counter to where SSH expects and return there. This whole process is called a context switch. And the saved information, that saved program counter and registers, is called a context. And a context sort of includes all our register values, it includes the condition codes, includes the program counter, it's all the state that's visible to the program. We need to save all that when we switch to another program, so we can switch back later, and it will be as if nothing happened, as if our loop just kept running. So if we forget to save anything, we could have problems. If we don't save the condition codes, whoops, you know, if we stopped our loop just before a conditional jump, we're in trouble. So we have to save all that information every time. And that's part of what the operating system is responsible for doing and part of the code the OS is going to have in its, what we'll call an exception handler, the code that runs when an exception happens. So our pseudocode for that context switch is that we're going to save the previous program counter. Here I have it as if we have a special instruction for that. The actual hardware mechanism varies, but one thing the hardware might do is make a copy of the program counter to a special register only the OS can access when an exception happens. And we'll save all the register values somewhere, restore the other register values, and jump to the program we want to run, in this case, to SSH. Yes? What happens to the stack? So stack is one of the registers we're saving. So in this process, we're going to have our stack pointer and everything else, you know, pointing to process A, the first program. And the OS will have a copy of the registers, including our stack pointer and our program counter for process B, and it will put those as our active registers, and that will change where the stack pointer points and change where the program counter points to the new program's stack and program counter. Stack and code, I should say. Yes?
So was the last slide just showing where you store everything from the last program
you run? Question, was this slide showing where we store everything? Yeah. So this is the code that would implement what I just showed a picture of. So we're copying to the OS memory our current registers and reading from the OS memory our new ones. Question back there?
Yeah, like how long is the overhead on it? Like when you have to put all of these things in registers?
So question is, what's the overhead of this? So I don't know what modern timings are. I think this process itself is like probably on the order of like maybe tens of microseconds, including like having the exception and so on. But the biggest part of context switch overhead is actually that when we switch from one program to another, our instruction cache and our data cache aren't so useful anymore. So that's actually the biggest cost of doing this in terms of performance, is that if I keep switching from one program to another, I'm going to have a lot more cache misses. But there is a direct cost, which is, you know, tens to hundreds of microseconds, probably. I haven't looked at what modern numbers are for that. But the biggest concern that OSs have about switching too often is not that direct cost, but the fact that our data cache and instruction cache are just going to have stuff for a different program, and therefore the new program will run slower. Okay, other questions? So these are our structures in the OS memory that contain the context for the previous program and the context for the new program. So last is where we're saving the current information, and next is where we're restoring our new program. So in the case of our example, last would be the part of the OS memory for loop.exe, and next would be the part of the OS's memory dedicated to ssh.exe. Yes.
So the OS has like separate memory to store
this. So the question, so the S would have separate memory to store these? Most typically, yes. It's not necessary to do that, but probably would. Other questions? Okay, so we've seen about saving and restoring registers. Let's talk about another issue, which is about memory. So like I've sort of shown that we have separate memory. That might not be entirely true. But you've run things on machines with multiple programs before. So let's say I have two programs here. I have program A, where I have decided to put the value 42 at a global variable located address 0x10000, just hard-coded address for a global variable. And here I load from that value into REX. And I have program B, and let's say it's running on the same processor, and we're doing that time multiplexing, it's the same core even. And let's say it just stores 99 into there. So my question is, what do you expect to happen based on your use of, you know, running programs on a machine? Like, what is your idea of what either would happen or should happen? Let's start with, should the result in program A be? I probably should actually not be asking about program B. So this should be crossed out. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks what should happen is A, that REX is just 42? Okay, which people? B, that should be 99. Couple. C, just the after. Okay. D, okay. E, 42 or a crash maybe. F, 99 or a crash. G, either of them, or crash, and H, something else. Okay, so we have wide disagreement, and the answer about what's going to happen here is that in program A, we're always, always going to get 42. Every single time. So the operating system is somehow going to arrange for program A to not be affected by that stuff that's going on in program B. And program B, well, something's going to happen in program B, and one of the things that might happen in program B is that it might crash. And so what's going on here is that there's something else that is part of this context switch I didn't mention, which is that we're going to have, we have two programs here, and those programs are going to have a memory layout that conventionally looks the same, and it looks like, you know, that their global variables are in the same place, but that's not really going to be the case. So they have the same address when the programs are running, but we don't want them to actually be the same values. We want it to be the case that program A writes, you know, has 42 in a global variable. If program B writes to the same address, we don't want any interference with that. And, well, one solution could be that when we do that context switch, in addition to saving registers, we could save the contents of memory. But that would be really, really slow. So that's not what we're going to do. Instead, we're going to have some help from the processor, and we're going to have this notion of an address space. So the program's going to run in an address space, which is going to give the program the illusion that it has its own memory. And the way we're going to implement that is that there's going to be a mapping the processor uses that determines when a program uses address, say, 10,000, what address is that really? And the operating system is going to set that mapping. And that's one of the things that we're going to change in a context switch. So in addition to changing all the register values, we're also going to set a new mapping based on what program we want to run. And that means when we switch from program A to program B in our example, address 10,000 is going to be somewhere else. Questions? Yes. So the question is, if we weren't using this mapping, the operating system would need to figure out where there's overlap and save those values? Is that your question?
No, if we are using it.
We are using this mapping. So if we're using this mapping, generally, as in this picture, the sort of default pattern will be that the two programs will have distinct memory, that they that any address accessed by program A won't be an address that program B can access. So you can see that if you go through these mappings, there's actually no way for program A to access program B's memory. So that's sort of the default. Some operating systems sometimes will share memory between two programs, but that's usually not the default behavior, or at least not visibly a default behavior. when you take operating systems, you will learn that there is a case where we'll share memory between two programs when that memory is read-only, in which case it's not visible, right, if you can only read it. Yes?
So then, like, in the example, it said that they were both accessing, like, I think it was, like, memory access 0-1 or something.
Yeah, so the question in the example, they were both accessing the same address. You're asking how does that, like, correspond to this? Question is, are either of them actually accessing that address? Probably not. So in both cases, the 0x10,000 is what goes on this side of the mapping. So it's entirely up to the OS what that actually maps to. It could map to the same address afterwards, or it could not. Does that answer your question? Yes. So why is it possible that program B would crash? So when we look at this program layout, we have these big regions here which are unmapped. So part of this mapping is that some addresses, and typically the default mapping, is the map to trigger an error. And what trigger an error does is it causes an exception to happen. It runs the OS, and the OS gets to decide what to do. And a common thing the OS will decide to do is say, well, this program did something that it shouldn't have done. I'll just kill it. I'll just get rid of its data from memory and run something else. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
So this wouldn't always happen?
So the question is that we wouldn't, that program B wouldn't always crash? Yes, because, well, It depends where 10,000 is in this diagram, right? It just could randomly be valid for program B. Right, we don't know what's at address 10,000 in program B based on this information. It could be, like, it could have a different global variable there. So in that case, it wouldn't be a crash necessarily. Yeah. Yeah, so the reason it might crash is that, you know, it could be the case that, like, OX10000 is in one of the, like, so it could be the case that OX10000 is in one of the sort of dashed and accessible regions, or could not be. We don't have enough information to know. Yeah.
But why would we write program B to access OX10000?
The question is, why would you write program B to access OX10000? So here, it was under the mistaken impression that you could access things in program A. Right, that's, we chose the address because program A chose that address. Other questions? Yeah.
Yes. I'm not entirely sure how to word this, but like, since the mapping kind of assigns like a fixed block of memory to each program, right? Or like it assigns a block of memory that might not, like, would you have enough memory for all the addresses you might ever want in the program?
Question is, would we have enough memory for all the addresses we might ever want in the program? Meaning, like, can the mapping specify enough? So we'll go into a lot more detail on that when we talk about what this, how this mapping is actually represented. So right now, I'm just saying, like, there's some function, right? Like, you could imagine it's like the OS just decides some function, and the mapping could be complicated. The mapping actually works in a very specific way, and that's going to be our topic after we talk about exceptions, called virtual memory. And the mapping is stored in something called a page table, and we'll talk in great detail about how page tables are stored and how we make them practical even when they need to map a huge amount of memory. Yes?
So the point of the mapping to prevent programs from accessing the same memory?
So the point of the mapping to prevent separate programs from accessing the same memory, so that is one view, is that the point is what we call memory protection, that keeping programs from accessing memory they're not supposed to. The view I prefer to have is what I have on the top of the slide, that I would prefer to interpret the point of the mapping is that we can give the programs the illusion that they have their own memory. That they kind of own the entire memory when they're running, that they can be written in that way. So I, when writing program A, for example, could just assume I can use address 10,000. Even though I might be running across with other programs that want to use address 10,000 too, I can act as if I own all the memory because there's this hardware mechanism to let the OS give me that illusion. Question?
So can you assume that the OS won't map to, like, things from separate programs to the same address?
So question, can we assume the OS won't map to things from the separate programs to the same address? The OS shouldn't do this unless there's a good reason to. Like, if the two programs requested it. So we mentioned we have this mapping. This is one of the things that's going to be changed in a context switch. So we'll change our register values, our program counter, and our address space, that current mapping. And when we combine this time multiplexing mechanism and this address space mechanism, we get what we call a process. And a process kind of gives you the illusion you have a dedicated machine. So we call this sort of abstraction you get of a CPU that, like, just has this delay, a thread, that kind of looks like you have your own CPU, your own core, I should say. Because, like, if we think of our loop just keeps running as if it owns this core all the time. It's written, not assuming we have to switch to other programs. We just act as if I'm going to keep running on the same core indefinitely. And we call that illusion a thread, that we give the program a thread. The thread is actually run on one core with other threads. So it's only an illusion that you have your own core. You don't really have your own core. But you write your program as if you have a core. And the same way, you write your program as if you have all the memory. And together, we call this a process. And this is sort of the main thing that operating systems implement, is this abstraction. Is that they let you write your programs as if you own a whole core or multiple cores, and you own all the memory. But they actually implement that in a way where they can share cores and share memory between multiple programs. So questions about this process idea? Yes?
Why can it process more than one thread?
Why can it process more than one thread? So we're not going to talk about what the interface is referring that would be, but commonly, rather than just having you write code that would run, you know, if you were had a dedicated machine on one core, there will be a mechanism of saying, I want to run this and this at the same time, preferably on different cores. And each of those two threads will be run by the operating system, possibly on different cores, possibly on the same core, with that time multiplexing idea. But commonly when people want to write programs that like could take advantage of multiple cores, they'll have a program that has multiple threads, so that it has pieces of code that are intended to run, you know, as if they had two separate cores dedicated to them. They're written that way, I should say. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so this process abstraction, this is the big thing operating systems do. Okay, so as I mentioned, we're going to talk about address spaces as a topic after exceptions. So first we're going to talk about exceptions. And I mentioned exceptions are ways of running the operating system, and we saw one reason the operating system would want to run is that we'd have some reason that we want to switch to another program. And there's a whole, actually, bunch of reasons exceptions happen, and here's a hierarchy from our textbook. And there's this high-level division of asynchronous exceptions and synchronous exceptions. So asynchronous exceptions is the name we give to exceptions that aren't triggered by the running program. So if we think of our loop, there was no code in there that triggered an exception. That the loop had just normal instructions that shouldn't run in the OS, and somehow the OS started running. So that was an asynchronous exception. I mentioned program B may be crashing because we accessed memory that wasn't mapped to it. That's known as asynchronous exception. There's something the program did to cause that to happen. So we talked about this context switching, and typically the way that works is that we have what we'll call interrupts are going to be our general name for externally triggered exceptions, and there's going to be one kind of them triggered by a timer. So most processors are going to have a timer that's either, you know, it was just, I guess, conceptually separate from the processor, but it's probably on the same physical package, that the operating system can program and make it trigger an exception, say, a millisecond later. So what the operating system will do is that when it starts running loop.exe, it will first set up this timer to make sure that if loop.exe runs for too long, that the operating system gets to run and decide what to do. So, you know, an OS just might configure this to like send a signal every millisecond, so the OS gets to run every millisecond and say, oh, is there some other program that would be better to run now? It can do that. Another type of these externally triggered exceptions is from I/O devices. So like if I press a key on a keyboard, the hardware mechanism that communicates with the keyboard is going to trigger an exception. It's going to run the OS, and the OS can say, okay, there was a key press. What do I want to do about that? So the OS can do things like storing the key that was pressed somewhere for later. And it can also do things like deciding, oh, well, since there was a key press, the SSH program can now run. Let's run it. And this is all the OS's code, so the OS decides what sort of policies to use to handle this. Does it want to handle the key press right away or not? It can decide that. Yes?
So would an example of this be like when you exit out of a program
Question, would an example of this be when you exit out of a program on your own? No, we'll talk about that later. Assuming you mean like control C or, so control C. So I guess that, yes, that I guess that would be an example of this where the US decided something in particular to do with a key press. So that would have been triggered initially by, yes, an interrupt. And the OS had a policy for that particular one to do something which caused the program to terminate. Rather than our typical reaction to a key press, which is like to send the information to a program. So if we think of responding to a key press, there's one piece here that I'm missing, is that if I think of like writing a program that reads input, I have to like request to read the input. And the way we're going to actually make any request of the operating system is with an exception. So I have this category in synchronous I've labeled traps, intentionally triggered exceptions. So programs will intentionally cause an exception to happen because that's how you can run the OS. You can't run the OS with a normal function call, so you have to trigger an exception. And the common type will trigger is called a system call. This is where we make a request of the OS to do something. And one thing we might ask the OS to do is, please get some keyboard input for me. So let's say I have a program that like reads some input from the terminal. What I might do is I might say, OK, I'll make a system call telling the operating system, hey, I want to read some input. And the operating system will remember that I want to read some input. And in the case of a typical read, if I'm waiting for input, I can't run right now. So the operating system would, in that case, switch from my read input program to something else. Because if the read input program needs to get input from the keyboard before it can run again, can't run it. How did that happen? So we'll have our system call, and then eventually we'll have an interrupt from that keyboard input, and the OS can say, oh, I remember earlier this program asked to read input, let's start it now. Yes. So the question is, when did traps happen? So traps are deliberately triggered exceptions. So the code in read input called this read library function. And the way the read library function was written is that it made a request to the OS using a special instruction that triggered an exception. Because as I said, we can't actually make a function call to the OS. We have to run it specially because it's, you know, doesn't share our address space and so on. Other questions? Okay, and we mentioned, sort of alluded to, so we have interrupts, these externally triggered events like timers and I/O devices. We have traps, these intentionally triggered things like, I want the OS to do something for me, like I want the OS to get some keyboard input from me and run other things while I'm waiting for that. That was our read system call. We also have faults, where programs do something that, you know, is an error or some weird event that requires handling. So examples are that crash, that if the program accesses memory it's not supposed to, or memory that's not mapped, I should say, regardless of whether it's supposed to access it, that will trigger a fault. The OS gets to decide how to handle that. This is why the message you see for going out of bounds is often segmentation fault. That's when that mapping isn't there. That's the message the OS has decided to print. When it gets that, we'll have a category called privilege instruction we'll talk about later. This also is what we use for like divide by zero. So if, that will trigger an exception. The OS decides, hey, this is told from the processor, hey, this program divided by zero, what do you want to do about it? Or if the program executes an invalid instruction. So if the processor doesn't know how to execute an instruction, it's going to ask the OS by triggering an exception, hey, this program did some. Try to execute an instruction that I don't understand. What do you want to do about it? typically the OS would crash the program, but the OS can do whatever it wants. It's just running code. It can decide like to like try to skip the instruction or whatever. Whatever the operating system writer, you know, could write code for. So whatever type of exception we have, we need to have this hardware implementation. So the hardware is going to detect that an exception happened. So this could be like it detects that we tried to look up an address in the mapping and it wasn't there, or it detects that we got a signal from the keyboard saying that there's input now. Whatever condition it's detecting, it's going to detect that. And then to handle the exception, it's going to have to first save the current value of the program handler. Why do we need to do that? Well, if it's an external event and we don't save that, we can't go back to the programs. Like if we think of running a loop, if we don't remember where the loop is, we can't go back to it. And we can't rely on the OS to save this because we're changing the program counter to run the OS. So we're overwriting that. So the hardware definitely needs to save itself the old program counter value so the OS can go back to it later. Yes? Question, is the OS itself storing the rest of the context? So different processors make different choices about this. So x86, the hardware actually saves a bunch of extra stuff, but the minimum you need to save is just the program counter, and there's some architectures which do that, some which don't. Which save only the minimum, I should say. This question is, after that program counter save is sent to the OS, and generally in some way. So there's multiple ways you could do this. So one example is you could have some extra registers that are only used by the OS and some special, like move from this special register instruction to access it. Another way you could do it is you could decide that the OS like specifies a memory location and it copies the program counter to that memory location. Okay, then we need to jump to the exception handler without the program actually having a jump instruction. So I'm going to describe a simplified version, as the textbook does, of like what exceptions might look like. Real x86 exceptions are complicated in silly ways. They involve a whole bunch of hardware concepts that are kind of obsolete, like things called segments, which we're not going to deal with. So I'm going to have sort of what an idealized, clean hardware exception implementation would look like, not what real x86 does. And we have to have some way of deciding where to jump to. So a common mechanism we might use to do this is we'll have a special register in our processor that I'll call the exception table base register. And we'll have this exception table, which will just be an array of pointers to our exception handling functions. And each element of this array will be for a different kind of exception. So for example, in this case, I've decided that element 0 is 4 divided by 0. An element with offset 40 in hex is for a timer interrupt. And we'll assign a different slot to each kind. And the OS will, at boot, set this exception table base register to point to some memory before it runs any program. And that will configure things so it will get run and it can run the appropriate routines for each kind of exception later. So questions? Yeah.
So for the elements of the array, they would be referring to like, the more specific kinds of exceptions, not the abort trap.
Question, the elements of the array would be referring to the more specific kinds of exceptions? Typically, yes. And there's tremendous variation in how you might how finely a processor would divide the kinds of exceptions. Other questions? Okay. So given this exception table, our hardware is again going to save the old program counter. It's going to do a table lookup to find the pointer to the OS code to run, and then jump there. Then the OS needs to, you know, decide what else it wants to do. So if it needs to save any other registers, it can do that and so on. Yes?
How do we figure out what the base is?
So there's going to be a special register in the processor that's only used for exception handling, and there's probably going to be a special instruction the OS can run to set that register. Other questions? Yeah.
Is this decided before, independent of the current running program?
This question, is this decided independent of the currently running program? So this is something the OS would set up at boot. So as part of booting, the OS would configure this data structure and set that special register. Question? Question, that special register is not visible in any program says yes? Yes, that would be the typical models that we'd have some registers that are only usable by the OS for this sort of purpose. I guess I should note, if we didn't want to have a special register, a technique that some processors use is that they just choose a fixed address that the OS must use. But more commonly, you'd let the OS choose an address by having a register. Yes.
And so is the reason that you have these new instructions for these two different kinds of exceptions because the OS will start by saving?
Question is the reason why my example has these move queue instructions for both of the examples is because the OS would always start by saving. So that would be very common for the OS to do, to always start by saving a bunch of registers. This isn't required. So like if the exception handling is very simple, maybe the OS can avoid doing that and save some time. But if you look at a typical OS, often the beginning of every single exception handler will be saving some value somewhere. Other questions? So to implement these exceptions, we needed to add this new instruction to set that exception table base register. We needed to add logic to our processor to jump based on the exception table. And part of this logic is that we might need to like cancel all the currently running instructions. So we think of like our out-of-order processor, like we're in the middle of running a bunch of instructions and we need to suddenly stop all of them and switch to what the OS is doing. We have logic to save the old program counter, and as I alluded to, we might save some extra stuff just for convenience somewhere to typically a special register or to somewhere in memory that the OS would have set up. And we're also going to need a special instruction to return from the exception handler to go back to the saved program counter. You might say, why can't we just use a normal jump? And we'll talk about that. We'll talk about the biggest reason for that later. The one reason why that might be difficult is that if we think of jumping back to loop.exe, we want to jump back with all the registers set correctly, and that might be tricky to do if we don't have a special instruction, but there's going to be a more fundamental reason why we're going to need one we'll talk about next time. So questions about these sort of things we need in the hardware? Yeah.
So the new logic for like saving to the old PC, would that also apply to like saving the old registers to the old PC?
So the question, the logic for saving the old PC, would that also apply for saving the old registers? So if the hardware does that for us, yes. So this is stuff the hardware is doing, but the hardware might not do that for the OS. Or more commonly, the hardware will save some of the registers, but not all of them. Like the hardware might save the stack pointer, but not the other registers. So our typical exception handler, the way it's going to work in this idea, is that probably, sorry, it's going to first save the current process's state somewhere, then it's going to do whatever the exception requires, and then it's going to switch to, restore a process's state. If we're switching to another program, that will be a different process. Sometimes we'll keep running the same process, and that's fine. We're going to restore the state back to where it was when the exception handler started. Yes?
So does exception handler refer to like, the functions that correspond to the different exceptions?
Question, does exception handler refer to the functions that correspond to the different exceptions? Yes. So by exception handler, I mean these handle functions here. So that's where we'll leave off this time. Next time we'll talk about sort of some security issues with exception handlers and how the hardware helps with that.